Well, hi, everybody. Hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Marnie Swedberg, and we are recording live today from Northwest Regional Library in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, where I am completing a tour of trainings on how to write an ebook, what an ebook is, and what it can do for you. And so I welcome you people who are here in the room with me, to you people who are listening online live right now, and also to anybody who listens in later. Welcome to you. We are going to cover a really lot of ground today, but I thought this would be fun for me to just find out from you guys who are here what your genres are. Now, you might say, I haven't even started the book. But then I want you to tell me what you're thinking of maybe writing in, a genre you're thinking of writing in, or if you don't even know that, you can tell me what's your favorite one to read. Okay, so how many are fiction writers, consider yourself fiction writers? Okay, and are there any romance writers? Sci-fi? What other kind of fiction we got going? Nope, just general fiction. Okay, and then we have how-to books. Any how-to books in here? Yeah? Okay, and history, along that kind of line, nonfiction, autobiography, biography. Okay, how about anybody that's telling stories, plays, poems? Okay, some poems. Okay, very good. Anything I missed? Okay. What we're going to talk about today is ebooks, what they are, who they're for, and why you should care and take action right now, as well as, along the way, we're going to cover a lot of ground that's just good, useful information for writers overall. I am a writer by kind of default. I don't get up every morning and think of myself as a writer. But my first book was published with St. Martin's Press in 1996, and I've gone on to publish a total of 11 books and ebooks. Mostly ebooks. They're mostly available for sale on my site, marnie.com, but you can buy some of them other places too, or you can get them for free someplace, some of them. So what I'm doing when I get up every day is I'm just living. That's all I do. I just get up and I do life. But in my responsibilities, which are multiple, I learn a lot every single day. And what I try to do is I try to share what I'm learning with basically anybody who wants to listen. Online, I am the web hostess of large sites. My sites last year got 5.7 million hits last year, so we got a lot of traffic going on at the website. One of the sites is for women speakers. It's called womenspeakers.com, and event planners come there to find their speakers, and I end up being a mentor to the speakers as well as to the event planners, so I work a lot with them. Also, we own a restaurant. We own a retail store, an espresso cafe, so there's lots of learning going on all the time. What I try to do is I try to take whatever is happening to me personally in my life right now and communicate it. And I narrow it down or actually broaden it out depending on which it needs. So sometimes what I'm learning right that minute fits into a 140-character social networking update. How many of you are on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, anything like that? Sure. Okay, so what they're called is they're called mini blogs. So what you do is you only get 140 characters, not words. Characters, and in that 140 characters, you have to communicate your whole thought. Well, it's really quite a challenge, but what I do is about four times a day, I communicate a thought on my social networking sites, and so I'm interacting with people that way. And then, if the thought is bigger, I write a blog post. Those are usually 300 to 500 words. If the thought is bigger, I write a 1,000-word article. If the thought is really big, I write an ebook of up to 100 pages. And if the thought is huge, I write a book. So we don't have too many books. We have 3 books, and the rest of them are ebooks, and then hundreds of articles and blog posts and social networking things. Today we are going to talk about how you can take your idea that is book links, or ebook links at least, and turn it into something that people can find online, especially online at Amazon.com. Now, you can, once you do it on Amazon, you can do it anyway, okay? But we're going with Amazon because that is the number one book-selling site online. If you get on there, you get lots of traffic potential. Doesn't mean you'll get lots of traffic. But if you follow the right steps, you should get some traffic and you should get some sales if you've done your free work. We're going to go through many steps today, 7 total steps, and by the time we're done, you're going to have more questions than answers. But you're going to know where to find the answers. And you're going to know for a fact that you can publish your book to Amazon in a very short period of time by following the steps I'm going to explain to you. The reason I can say that for sure is because I was called by Barb Jo K. Kalinowski on January 5th, and I was given 16 days to prepare for this presentation. And during that period of time, now it's a little longer than that because we had weather that came in there, but during that period of time, I had to research and write up the notes for you all here and get ready to present this training in 16 days. And then I was going to go do it at 7 locations in a 3-day period. That's pretty fast, but that's what I do. The fastest one I ever did in pinch hit speaking was I had 24 hours and I had to give 4 1-hour lectures on different topics back to back with the starting in 24 hours over a 2-day period. So that's what I do. I love the challenge and I love this challenge. The day after I got the call from Barbara Jo K. Kalinowski, I had already begun researching. If you're a writer, research is critical. You have got to get it right. You've got to get it right, and you've got to get as much of it as you can. You don't want to leave parts out for people, or they notice that. It's an uncomfortable feeling for them. They're not sure they can trust you. If you left things out, they don't know if they can trust you, so be sure to do good research. I immediately began doing research, which led me within one day to find some very interesting things. First of all, I found out that things had changed. Even though I had published 10 e-books at the time, books or e-books, I had blinked, and in 2 years, things had radically, radically changed. And as I began to uncover these changes in the news media reporting and the things that we were uncovering with the research, it became obvious to me that I had a lot of work to do to get ready to train you guys. Within a little bit longer, it became obvious that the amount of work I was going to do would be much bigger than a 1-hour presentation. I simply could not teach it that fast. There was too much information. I would have to give you more, you know, if Laura wanted you to succeed. So I was commissioned with the Northwest Regional Library to come train you on this, and that is what I was determined to do. And so what I did is I decided if I'm going to go through all the effort to learn it myself and come up with the notes for you, I might as well put it in a situation where everybody can get access to it, right? All authors, anybody who wants to publish a book could get access to it. And then I decided, okay, I got 16 days. So by day 14 for sure, I need to have this whole thing ready so I could email in the notes so they could make the copies. Now I have 14 days. And I thought, what can we do in 14 days? And you know what we did in 14 days? We wrote a book, wrote a whole book, and published it on Amazon.com. This book, this e-book, became a sellable product published onto the internet at Amazon.com with me as the author without any agent or publisher in 14 days from the phone call. Prior to that phone call, I had never even considered writing a book about how to write an e-book, even though I'd been doing it for years. And do I recommend that you write your book and publish it on Amazon in 14 days? No, because I didn't sleep much. The life kind of all stood still. But what I do want you to know is that it's extremely doable. You could do it. What if it took you 10 times longer than me? That's only 140 days. That's half a year. That'd be remarkably fast to publish a book onto Amazon. What if it took you quite a bit longer? It doesn't matter how long it takes. What matters is that you know you can do it. So that's why I'm here, to help you know you can do it and know how to do it so that if you want to, if it's what you decide to do, you can be successful. Then what happened is 2 weeks ago on Saturday, our trainings were canceled because of weather, and I stayed home. And I thought that day, I thought, you know, I wonder how hard it is now. I mean, if it's that easy to publish an e-book onto Amazon, how hard would it be to publish a book, like a paperback? So I began to look into that. My paperback version of this book is currently in review at Amazon.com. It's being published right now, and it will be online for sale in paperback within just a week or two from right now. That means in 6 weeks, it went from idea all the way to published. That is remarkable. There's never been a time in history when that could have been possible before, but it is possible now. Not only is it possible, it's so exciting. My mind just thinks of so many people who have things that they should be publishing for the public. I think of all the pastors of individual churches and parishes who give sermons every Sunday. And what if they just put their sermons together into a book, published it, and at the end of the year, they let their church people or their parishioners buy a copy and give it to family members or friends? Wouldn't that be something? What about a business? that came up with a new concept. Maybe they have a new concept for organizing information, and they've been using it in their own business, and it's been making a remarkable difference there. What if they could just put it into a book format and publish it on Amazon for all of us to benefit from? This thing makes it possible for any individual author to publish their own work in a short period of time and make it available to the public. I just think it's huge, and I just, well, Barb, I think I'm still in shock because it's just such a change. I've been thinking about finding publishers ever since 1992. It's the first thought I had of that. I mean, it's been the most difficult part of writing is getting it published. And now all of a sudden you're telling me that in 6 weeks you can take an idea to publication without any help? It is mind-boggling the days in which we live. And you are part of it. You get in on this, and I'm so excited to share it with you and with everybody who listens to this afterwards. Number one, what is an ebook and why should you care? An ebook just means an electronic book. That's all it is, an electronic book. And it used to be that they were almost all put into play in PDF form. So somebody would buy an ebook, you would open it on your computer screen and either read it there or print it out onto a piece of paper. So it used to be that the right length for an ebook was 80 to 120 pages, because if you sold them an ebook that was like 320 pages, I mean, that goes through more than half a ream of paper. People don't like you. They don't want to be printing that much out. Now, though, with the little handheld readers, things have really changed. Handheld readers are just a little bigger than this. They have a screen, and they are increasing in popularity exponentially, very, very fast. On December 25th of this last year was a day in history for all authors. Amazon sold more ebooks than they sold paperbacks, paper version of any kind. That's unbelievable. Right now, libraries like this library are able to access over 300,000 books in e-version. Oh, it's amazing. And as authors, we have to pay attention to this. What we're looking at here with this, though, is just the tip of the iceberg. We're just seeing the little top right now. This thing is going to go wild. And why do I say that? And I don't think, in saying that, I don't think paper books are going away anytime soon. Paper books are here for a long time yet. But the e-readers are so user-friendly that it is only a matter of trying one before you're hooked. That's how user-friendly they are. Here's some things about them. You can save up to 1,000 books in that little unit. 1,000 books. Think about people who travel. I mean, when you used to fill your suitcase half full with books, right? Now you can just take your little handheld. They're backlit. So if you're reading in a pitch-black hotel room and your spouse is sleeping, no problem. You've got your light right inside your handheld. What if your eyes get tired? Well, you can make the font bigger. You can take any book immediately to large print. You just press a button. Amazing. Finally, now there's two more things. If you get really tired, you just press a button, pick a male or female voice, and it will read you the story. Go for that. Finally, if you are confused about a word, you just mouse over it with your finger, and it will give you the definition. Oh, now we're talking convenient reading, right? So no wonder literacy is going up. It's our young people who always live on their phones. They are figuring this thing out. You mean I could just read on my phone unit on something that small? They're doing it. They're listening to books. I mean, it's just an amazing time in which we live. They're called it a reader. It's a handheld reader. Handheld reader. That's all it is. There are three audiences. We're just going to go right plow through now. And if you have questions, I so want to answer them. But if you want to save them to the end, then I'll be able to get through with the information that you need to know. There's some really critical things here. I don't recommend that anybody just says, oh, because she did it in 14 days, I'm going to throw something together and stick it out there. That's suicide. Don't do it. Listen all the way through the end. And please do take notes, and we'll answer the questions at the end. The other thing is, for you who are here present, the Northwest Regional Library System has part of this training is that you get a free copy of the ebook. So afterwards, just know that you'll be able to get the book for free. And anybody who's listening in can just order it online. Okay, there are three audiences to whom every author needs to write. Three. In my notes, I said two, but that's because I only found out about the third one on Thursday. But it's true. I did it subconsciously, but she explained why we have to do it consciously. The first audience you need to write to is your target reader. Who are you writing for? Think about the difference in writing to someone who's into extreme sports, a mother with little children, or a man who's going to want to build a garage. I mean, you've got radically different pace going. You've got different voice. You've got different issues. You've got everything about those people is different. But you have to narrow down who it is that you are writing for. And then my next piece of advice is whatever you're writing on your computer screen or whatever, you put that person right there. You pick a person that you actually know that fits that description, and you write to that person. So whether you're telling a story or you're going through step by step, what you want to do is you want to communicate with a person. I'm going to ask you a question. How many of you find an author that you like and you think when you're done with that book, I wonder if they wrote any other books? And you like go to the back or go to the front and you're like, did they write any? Oh, and you go get all the books they've written. How many of you do that? I do that. I totally exhaust an author. Which authors do you exhaust? Probably not the same ones I exhaust. Okay? Because what happens with an author is that author connects with a certain group of people, and those people just want everything that that author has to give. My challenge to you and your challenge as an author is to write in such a way that people feel that way about your work. But they're like, I hope they come out with another one quick, because I need people call me a Marnie fix. That's what they say. They need a Marnie fix. So, and what that is just people who want another book. They want some more to read, like what they already read. You accomplish that by speaking to one individual person, not to the general masses. The second audience you need to address is your future publisher. Why would you care if you could, like for me, I mean, I published this without a publisher. Why would I care about a future publisher? Several reasons. First of all, my budget for this book was just very low, okay? A publisher, I was just talking to a publishing consultant on Thursday, Donna Silvio, and she said that a publisher will put up to $30,000 behind a book that they believe could be a bestseller. I mean, I don't have $30,000 to put behind my book. That's a lot of money. They have entire editorial staff. They have cover artists. They have marketing people who are out there doing your PR. There's all kinds of things that are happening. They have salesmen who are going door to door at the different bookstores and selling your book onto the shelf. There's all kinds of things that are happening that you as an individual author have a very difficult time duplicating. It's really hard for us to do that one by one. So when you're writing your book, ideally, if it can bubble to the surface a little bit, that a big publisher would maybe consider picking it up. From my perspective, and I haven't proven this out yet, but it's a theory. From my perspective, if your book can bubble to the top as an ebook or a book at Amazon.com and start getting some good hit sales, you'll have a much greater likelihood of getting the attention of an agent or publishing house than any other single thing you could do. Why is that? Because the economy's tight and everybody feels it, including publishers. They have to make money or they can't stay in business. If you look like a home run author, they're going to want to have you as on their books. If you've never written or published anything before and you haven't done anything with your work, but you want them to invest thousands of dollars, why should they? They've got other people who are busy out there doing it. So it's an opportunity for you to take advantage of this opportunity right now to get onto Amazon with your book and to make sure that you do it in such a way that a publisher would be happy to pick it up if it did start to bubble to the top. In the book, there's an entire appendix by Kathleen Kuhl, who wrote the book 12 Keys to Writing a Book That Sells. She is a former editor herself, and her whole book was fantastic, but it's out of print. She gave me permission to use many, many questions in the back, and they are questions that an acquisition editor will ask when considering your book or your book proposal for print. You need to siphon your work through that and make sure that you get the yes answer to most of those questions before you publish. It's a great way to check your work before it goes online. The third group that you're going to want to write for are the media. And you say, well, why would I need to write for the media? Because the media is who publicizes your book. You hear on the radio, you hear from experts and people all the time. On TV, they bring somebody in, you know. When Michelle Obama was the campaign going on, there were all kinds of authors who were talking about her attire. And, you know, should we wear sleeveless shirts now? And all kinds of things about her clothing. Authors who had written a book about that all of a sudden became authors that were being interviewed on newscasts and on TV. There's all kinds of news happening all the time. If you can tie your topic into a news item that comes around frequently, you have much more chance, a better chance of getting interviewed on the media. They're always asking the question, what's in it for me? So if you send them a print release and say, I've got a great book, good. So do thousands of other people. But if you send them a press release and it says, tonight on the news you're probably going to be covering thus and such, my book, thus and such, addresses that exact topic, I'm available for comment, well, what do you think? Your chances go up significantly, right? So when you write your book, you want to be thinking about the potential media coverage. Can you write it in such a way so that you become the person that they want to ask some questions about or to when something comes up in the news? Okay, those are the three audiences. Templates is the next item on your list there. What is a template? I call a template just a strong beginning. When you buy a new house and you're moving into a house and you walk into the bedroom and you whip open the closet door, you don't stand there and go, I wonder if I should tie my shoelaces around this rod up here. I could probably fold my clothes and put them on the floor. Maybe my shoes would be better on this shelf. No, you know exactly what to do with your clothes. It's set up in such a way that you don't even have to think about it. You put the hangables on the rod, you put the shoes on the floor, you put the foldables on the top, or if there's a side thing, right? There's no thought. When you are writing, you want to be focusing on your words, not on the closet, okay? You want to be focusing on the clothes. So what you do is you set up a template, and you do it the same way every single time. So this is going to save a tremendous amount of editing and rework when you're done. For me, I'm just going to tell you what mine is, okay? Amazon's Kindle Reader, their reader, they have actually created a font style that is it's required. It automatically defaults to that font style when you publish an ebook on the Kindle. It looks a lot like Georgia. So I figured if Amazon thinks that every person in the world wants to read Georgia font in their handheld, that's the one I'm going to go with when I write an ebook. They've already done all the research why that's a good font. So I just picked a Georgia, and one thing you're never going to see if you go and pick up any book out there, you will never see two or three or four different font styles in that book. All the way from start to finish, you're going to see one font style. But editors across their desk every day come manuscripts that have many different font styles because somebody thinks it looks cute. Don't do that. One font style, that's your template. And then you say, every time I come to a chapter heading, how am I going to mark that chapter? You're going to take and you're going to do your title. For me, it's same font, so Georgia, centered, 18, bold, black. Okay. How are you going to do your subheadings? For me, left justified, 12 thoughts, bold. How am I going to do my indented list? Always the same. How am I going to do my numbered list? Always the same. How am I going to do my larger passages of quotations? Always the same. What happens? How am I going to do my bibliography? How am I going to do my citations? Always the same. What happens is if you set it up before you start, you're going to not ever need to think of that again. You'll do it right the first time and save yourself hours and hours of either you editing it or you paying somebody to edit that out. So what I encourage you to do, I encourage you to go out into the stacks after the program and you find a book that you really like, one of your favorite books, and you just look at how they did it. There you go. Use that as your template. How have they laid it out? I mean, you can't copy the words, but the layout is free. You can copy the layout. Okay, templates are a great way to save time and money. Keyword research is number four. What in the world is keyword research? What's a keyword anyway? If you think of a traditional book, a keyword, you would find keywords in the index at the back of the book. You'd go to the back of the book and you'd say, you know, where was that passage about, Okay, he was in the Amazon forest. Amazon. Okay, so you go in the back and you flip until you find the Amazon forest. Well, people on Amazon.com search for stuff in your book or search for books on your topic in the exact same way. It's like it's a humongous index of all the printed materials. So they type in a word up here, and if that word matches your title, your subtitle, in your description, it will be presented to the viewer along with the other options that match. So you want to really take some time and make sure that your title, your subtitle works for your people. For the people that want to read your book. You want to be sure that your title is clear, but the first thing you want to do is look for keywords. Now, in your notes, you'll find the web address for Google Keyword Tool. If you go to Google and type in Keyword Tool, it'll pull it up right there. The first thing, it's free. All you do is you pick what your main word is. So in our illustration, my main word was ebook because I was hired to train you how to write an ebook. Okay? So I typed an ebook into the Keyword Tool. Up popped all the answers. And at the very top of the list was the word ebooks. 2.7 million hits per month. Per month. 2.7 million times that is searched for. That's a really lot. If you're writing a book, you want to make sure that your search results has more than 20,000 a month. Less than 20,000 a month means that probably your mom and maybe your aunt are going to buy your book. You need a bigger market than that. So you want to find a keyword that's going to help people find you so they can buy your book. Okay? What happened for me is when I did that, ebooks popped up. Now, my whole purpose at that point, I wasn't even thinking of writing a book at that point. My whole purpose in looking it up was that I wanted to use that word then, whatever the top one was, I wanted to go over to Amazon.com and finish my research so I could write up this training. I was going to go over there, type the word that came up, ebooks, into the Amazon search tool, and I wanted to find the one or two or maybe three books that had that exact title. It's the number one search term. There were going to be books by that title. I wanted to know what was in their table of contents. Why would I do that? Because if they had taken the time to find the keyword, I knew that they were a good author, that they were right up to speed with what's going on. And what I wanted to do for you is I wanted to make sure that I didn't leave anything out. So by looking at their table of contents, I would say, yep, got that one, got that one, got that one. What is that? I don't even know what that is. Jot it down, research that. Got that one, got that. You know how you're going to do when you're doing research. You make sure that you cover all the bases. But what I found when I got to Amazon.com was that no one had written a book titled ebooks. And so it was at that moment that I felt my 11th ebook coming on. I thought, okay, if nobody did this, and I have to do all this research anyway, I'm going to write that book. So that's where this title came from. Now, you can see that the title itself is ebooks. I took that number one keyword, and I made it into a title. Then, underneath that, we played and played and played and played with what the subtitle would be. But in the end, the subtitle expresses three things. First of all, it says the word Amazon, which in today's culture equates humongous bookstore. Okay? It says 14 days, which equates in any time really, really fast. And then it defines it a little farther by saying it isn't manuscript to Amazon in 14 days. It's idea to manuscript in 14 days. If you have a polished manuscript in hand, you have already done all the work. It's all edited and ready to go. You just can't find a publisher to put it out there. You really literally could hire a Kindle formatter, and within 24 to 48 hours, it could be published on Amazon.com, and it really is that easy. Like I said, still in shock about this because it's really pretty amazing, pretty amazing. Okay, keyword research is really important. I did invest quite a bit of time. I hired three people online, three outsources. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, to help me brainstorm chapter titles. Why? Once again, If you can use as many keywords in your chapter titles, you'll get found more often and will show up higher in the search engine results. The search engine is everything. You think about if you've got a manual or whatever, how many times you go to the back of that and you look in that index to find what you need. That's what people are doing online every day for everything imaginable. If your book meets a niche, a felt need in your niche, people are going to buy it. That's just how it is. We are an information-starved culture, even though we've got information coming out of our ears. We want it when we want it, and we want it fast. So if you write a book that meets a need, people will find it, and people will purchase it if you follow the right steps. How to write for handhelds and iPods. Or POD rather, not iPods. Yeah, they are, handhelds are iPods. So you have the Kindle, you have the iPod, the iPad, there's other ones too. Those are all different kind of technologies. And I talk about in the outsourcing section how you could find someone to help you format it. You get it all ready. I don't recommend you format it yourself, but you can learn that if you want. If you have time, you can learn that whole process. But otherwise, I think it's like $200 usually about to have it formatted. And then you can publish it onto the site. So how do you write it for an e-reader? Used to be for PDFs, they were getting pretty fancy at the end here. It started out just black and white text, you know, just straightforward. And then people started realizing, you know, with a PDF, you could put all kinds of pictures and different stuff in there and charts and graphs, and they got pretty elaborate. Now we got to go back again to easier, because what you've got is you've got a little tiny screen, okay? If you've got like a pie chart, that on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper is this big, and you've got it divided into 8 sections, you know what size that font is, right? Okay, it's pretty small already. Now you shrink it down onto a handheld, you're talking really small. And even though they can make it bigger to look at it, they'd have to go, you know, mouse over to this side and try to see it and get around. It would be really hard to read. What you want to do is right now, unless you're just really wealthy and you can afford a lot of formatting fees, you want to just keep it really simple, just for now. Probably a year from now, I would change what I said here. But right now, keep it simple. Just go straight through your text. Don't try any of the little call-out boxes. Don't do any of that fancy stuff this week, because right now it costs a lot to get that formatted for the handheld, and it throws the pages off. It just really changes the experience for the reader. Just take them straight through. In order to make it so it's not terribly boring for them, if it's a how-to book or something that can have sections, you would take and you'd put extra bullet, extra section, subsection headings within the chapter, do indented lists and things like that. Okay? And then if it is a fiction book, fiction readers are used to just straight plowing through. Don't mess with me. Don't put a subchapter heading in there. Get me to the information right away. So that is what you're going to do first. And then you're going to find someone who can help you upload it. Now, obviously, once again, you can learn it yourself if you have a lot of time. But if you want to, there's just people in the book. There's resources. The person who did mine, as well as lots of other choices. There's so many resources in the book, way more than I could ever possibly share with you here. POD, then, that's the difference. Now, handheld, we're talking about the e-book format. POD is print on demand. That's been around for a little bit, but somehow I never put my name on it, which was really too bad. But I'm excited that my name's on it now, and your name can on it be on it from today forward. Print on demand is the most amazing opportunity for authors that I just can't even believe it's an opportunity. When I think about an e-book, I think about something that's really fluid. If I publish an e-book and I get more information that fills out the content, all I do is I just tweak the ebook, I make the changes, put it up online, and you're done. That's how easy it is. It's just like changing a file. So easy. When you print a paperback book, there's nothing fluid about it. Once that baby goes to print, you are locked in until the next revision of that book, because some books never get revised. So you really, with a book, you're locked in. Until now, I was so scared when I was at the stage for taking my ebook to paperback. I was just so scared because, well, here's, I'll give you a little backstory. Before we took it to ebook format, before we published it that way, it had gone through 8 edits. So first I used an online editor, edited it, Had another person edit it, another person edit it, edited it myself again, another person edit. Finally, the last person to edit it was a high-priced editor. And when I got it back from her, I thought, you know what, I'm not even going to look at it. If I look at it, I'm going to change something and I'm going to mess it up. So I'm just going to send it directly over to the Kindle formatter. So I sent it over to the Kindle formatter. 2 days later, I got it back. And guess what? There's a typo in the first sentence on the first page. It's like, I can't believe this. And I start looking, and there were more. And it's like, how could that possibly happen? Well, how it could happen is very easily. This product now has been through almost 30 edits. There are still errors. And I'm not talking about people who don't know what they're looking at. I'm talking about English teachers and newspaper editors and people who know what they're looking at. It's extremely difficult to self-edit or have a book edited on your own. Even the big houses, there's usually one or two or three errors that slip through. But the difference is they have an editorial staff that their entire life is spent editing books for publication. And I tell you what, they don't last long in that industry if the books go to market with mistakes. They learn really fast how to find them all and get them out of there. And we are, as an individual author, publisher, you are really at a disadvantage on this one. It's tough. Here's my consolation for myself. First of all, we live in a culture of text messaging. If you've ever noticed how people write text messages or emails to each other, you notice that there's a lot of typos, spelling errors, all those kind of things. I'm not excusing errors in any way, shape, or form, and the goal is to get them all out. But when I see one, I just go, well, okay, on the revision, we're going to take care of that, okay? But you're just going to have to go because you're never going to get them all. Even my professionally published ones by the St. Martin's Press, it had errors. You're not going to be able to get it perfect. Even if you get every typo and every sentence structure and everything else right, you're going to wish you had changed a phrase here or there. You'll never be done editing. So my encouragement to you is keep working on it until you get it the best you possibly can, and then take it to print. All right. Writing for POD. When you get to the paperback version, I was so scared to go from eBay to paperback because of this locked-in feature. And I said to Gaines, who was my consultant, I said, okay, so like, what if I take this book to print and I find an error, just something I can't live with? How hard is it for me to fix that error after it goes to print? And he said, well, you would adjust the file and upload it again. I said, really? He said, that's it. That's it. It's as easy as an ebook. It's completely fluid because they never even print your book till the order is placed. So that is amazing. How do they pull that off? What they do is they have these print-on-demand centers. They guarantee that it's going to be to the shipping dock door at the same time as the books they're pulling off the racks. We've got these people over here making your book one by one, and it's going to be at the shipping dock door to go out the door at the same time as the other books that merchant ordered right then. It's amazing. It's amazing. And it is really too good to be true, except that it is true. So print on demand, you want to, once again, be careful about your formatting there. You don't want to go heavy into the extensive type of things where you're going to have to be buying illustrations and buying photographs and things like that. You want to go with a paperback version that you can inexpensively get published out there. And why I say inexpensively is because, honestly, most of the books out there on the shelf don't have a lot of graphics. The people who put a lot of graphics in typically are authors who are a little unsure of themselves, and so they want lots and lots of graphics. That's different if you're doing a children's book or something like that. That's all pictures. That's a totally different story. But if you're just doing a straightforward book, go ahead and find the book that's laid out like you would like yours to be and mimic that format, and you'll find that there's very little funky stuff going on in your book. It is the words themselves that will sell your book. So write it right. Okay, plagiarism, what it is and how to avoid it. This is so important. If you write a book and you have stolen someone else's material in it in any way, shape, or form, and it goes to press and you sell one book and they find out about it, you're liable. That's fraud. So you could sell one book and get tied up with thousands of dollars of legal fees for selling one book with someone else's material in it. Just avoid it like the plague. That would just be so tragic. And it happens to authors without them even realizing that they're doing it. It's very easy to fall into plagiarism. I want you to write down a website. It's essayrater.com. If you think of a high school essay, E-S-S-A-Y, and then the second word follows right on it, R-A-T-E-R, S-A-Writer, R-A-T-E-R, essayrater.com. That site is the site that you'll want to take advantage of. That site or another site like it, but I really like that one. You copy and paste a chapter of your work in at a time. And what it does is it takes you through your first level edit. It finds your typos and your grammatical errors and says, oh, you used passive tense. Did you want to use, you know, active tense? It takes you through, obviously, you don't have to change it. Like sometimes I would want to say shoe or something like that. And they'd say, that's not really a word. And it's like, well, that's the word I wanted. So you can leave it. You don't have to change it. You keep your voice, but it will help you to be technically correct in every place that it isn't a voice issue, that it's actually a technicality. What's so cool, and we came upon this by accident, I had already hired a bibliographer. So any time that you're using a quote from somebody and you need to give them credit for that quote, okay? In a longer passage, you actually have to get permission and oftentimes pay for permission. You have to get that. You can't just use even if you give them credit, you can't just use it. It doesn't belong to you. If it's a very short quote, usually you can. The exception is if it's a passage that, like, this is the whole thing. Like someone writes a two-line poem and puts their name at the bottom. If you use that two-line poem without getting their express permission, it's plagiarism because it's the whole content of what they wrote. That's it. Now, if you found that same two-line poem in the middle of a 200-page novel, you could pull that poem out and give credit at the end and be okay. I'm not a lawyer. I lived next to a lawyer once, but that's quotes I get. But in your notes, and if you go online, there's a site called, I'm going to give it to you right here, www.plagiarism.org. How easy is that? There's a site on there. If you type in their search engine, citations, they will explain the exact legal terms that you have to comply with to be legal here. You don't want to commit fraud when you're writing. You want to write it right. And then what you do over at this little essay writer, I had hired a bibliographer to put together my bibliography. Bibliographies are a pain. I don't know if you've ever done one, but they're just a pain. It's just real technical, and you have to get all the formatting right, you know. And I hired somebody out, and he was having a hard time because I hadn't kept good enough notes as I went along. And then I was doing some editing in this little essay writer. And all of a sudden popped up, plagiarism alert. It appears that you have taken this content from some other page, some other published material. Did you want to cite this? And then it makes the bibliography citation for you. And you copy and paste that at the end of your chapter, and you've got your bibliography. It's the most wonderful time-saving thing. So I had to Skype over to the bibliographer I hired and said, okay, I hope you have something else to do today because I really don't need you. He was really relieved because I had given him a mess to work with. But that is a wonderful shortcut. You need to be really careful about whose words you use. This applies to not only words, it applies to photos, charts, anything. Just because you search Google and find it does not mean you can have it. Most of the pages on the web, almost all of them, at the bottom, have a little teeny thing that says copyright. It's all copyrighted. Don't take anything without asking, and don't quote anybody without giving them proper citation. Okay? Very, very important. Number 7 is 2.0 and a sad, sad story. In 2002, I think, must have been before, maybe 2001, I was planning a scavenger hunt. And I love throwing scavenger hunts, and I've thrown a lot of scavenger hunts ever since my teenage years. And so I had taken out my file, and I'd kind of flipped through there, and I thought, oh, I've kind of done all these. Then I went over to my computer, and I typed in scavenger hunts like I'd done so many times before and couldn't find anything. There were some treasure hunts, but not scavenger hunts, a little bit different. And so I was back to my file, going through again, looking for a tool I could put together, something I could do to do this differently. All of a sudden, the thought occurred to me, hey, okay, I've got a file this thick full of scavenger hunts, and I've just been online looking, and there weren't any to find, which means other people would be online looking for scavenger hunts and couldn't find any. Maybe I should write a scavenger hunt book. Huh, that'd be easy. It was actually one of the easiest books I ever wrote because I already had it almost all done. I just had to kind of type it in, you know, format it and get it out. So I published it as an ebook on my website, and it started selling right away. People were finding it right away. And because it was there wasn't anything else like it. If they were looking for scavenger hunts, they couldn't find anything. So they came to my site and bought it. So anyway, after a couple years, people kept telling me over this year, they say, well, can't you get that to me in a paperback? I'd really like a paperback, too. So what happened is that after a couple of years, I found a publisher, published it in paperback. And then what happened at my site is that people would come to my site and they'd buy both. They'd buy the ebook and the paperback because they were planning a party tonight or tomorrow, so they had to have it right now. They really wanted paperback so they could pull it off the shelf later. So I was getting double sales, and plus it was over at Amazon at different booksellers, and so it was selling as a regular book. Perfect. This was great. This went on for a couple of years. And all of a sudden, one day, the book quit selling. It just, boom, no sales at all. Well, it had been selling really consistently for nearly 5 years at that time. I was like, well, what happened? So I started to look back and find out what happened. And I thought, well, maybe it went out of print. Because my first book, that's what happened to my first book. St. Martin's Press took it out of print without ever telling me. It was kind of like one of those, oh, didn't anybody ever tell you? And I was like, no, nobody told me. I couldn't buy any extra copies. I don't even have copies to give to my own children. It just one day was gone out of print. So I thought, well, maybe that's what happened to Marnie's Scavenger Hunt Handbook. So I contacted the publisher, and they were like, no, we're good. Everything's going. Everything's good. Okay. So I thought, well, maybe my website is down. So I went to the sales page of my website, but no, that was all there. It was working good. So I thought, well, maybe I Googled something's weird, but I went over there, and everything was just right. What is going on? So then finally I made my way to Amazon.com. And I'm looking at it. It's okay. It looks good. And there's books in print. And I'm scrolling down and all of a sudden, it happened. This is terrible. My little scavenger hunt book had never had a positive or negative comment at Amazon in all that time. People had sent me lots of positive comments and said, we had a great party. Thanks for the book, you know. Like that, but nobody had ever made a comment on Amazon.com, and actually that's not too unusual. My book, Marnie's Kitchen Shortcuts, has been out since 1996, and it has 8 total comments, that despite the fact that it sold thousands of copies. So all of a sudden, after all this time of no comments at all, within 1 week, 2 people said, we didn't like this book. One person said, I could have found all of this information by searching Google, and I wanted to say, yeah, but where do you think they got it? And then the second person just said, totally not what I was looking for. You know, both of them had valid points. But because they were the only 2 people who had given feedback on my book, it died. That was it. So what I thought was, I thought, okay, all these people had sent me personal emails. So I would just contact them and say, will you please just go over and give me a positive comment? I'll even cut and paste what they said and ask them, you can even just cut and paste this and put it on Amazon.com. I would appreciate it so much. Out of the people I contacted, only 1 person had the courage to do it. Why? Because, okay, now you have 2 people up here saying, lousy book. You have 1 person saying, good book. What if the next 3 people say, lousy book? What happens to this person? They're completely undoubted. This is a society where people do not stand up for what they truly believe unless other people validate them. It's terrifying, but it's true. And it's a double-edged sword for an author because once you get that publishing feedback at Amazon.com, you cannot do a thing about it. Just this week, I interviewed the second-ranking Amazon reviewer, and he said, I said, isn't there anything authors can do? Some people are literally just going around Amazon.com blasting books. That's all they do. And they just crush people's hopes and dreams, and all that work goes flying out the window. I said, isn't there anything you can do? And he said, no, there's really not. He said, if you respond, oftentimes you get into a firestorm, he called it, where people just get really nasty and it's just really bad. And if you don't respond, that's all there is to it. It's just a negative review. And it's really tough for you to get people to write positive ones once there's a negative one. In the book, before I published this book, I knew this to be true because of what had happened to me with my scavenger hunt handbook. And so when publishing this next one to Amazon.com, I had a plan. So what I was going to do is I was going to contact different people and ask them to give me positive review. Well, I just send them the copy of the ebook and ask them to review it. And if they felt like they wanted to, they could give me positive feedback. Nobody should ever feel like they have to. They don't have to. But if they want to, they could. Well, what happened is the ebook was published, and then pretty soon one person, like within a day, one person put a positive review. And then another person put a positive review. Then another person put a positive review. Within a couple of days, there were several positive reviews. And that was going fine until yesterday. By yesterday, there were 9 5-star excellent reviews. Now, remember, that's more reviews than I ever had for all the thousands of books sold over here. Why did I get those? Because I asked for them. It wouldn't have just happened. But what happened now, yesterday, somebody found it, and they gave me a scathing 1-star review. It was a terrible review. First of all, the person said they could find any of the information on Google. Again, okay, true. And then, but of course there was more in there than that. There's all the experience that came out of my head and my own past experience. And what I did is what every author does. After you write the content, you go and you find the experts and you find the quotes and you find the things, the links and the support statistics that make it work. And you change it if it doesn't match with what you were thinking. You have to change for the truth. But every author knows that you have to do research. And, of course, most everything's on Google right now, so it's true. But the question is, when you buy a book, would you rather have someone else do all the research work for you and narrow it down to the most important things in a logical order, or would you rather have spent several dozen hours doing that yourself? That's what you buy in a book. That's why you bought it. He went on to explain that it was so funny because it was so malicious. He said, it appears that Miss Marnie has convinced, has asked 5 or 9 of her friends to give her a 5-star ranking on this book. So I usually would not respond, but it was just too perfect. So what I did is I did respond, and to that comment, this is what I have to say. All 9 of those people that gave me 5-star reviews are professionals. If you take their name and you put it into Google.com, you can easily find their websites. They have their entire reputation at stake. They did not just say I had a 5-star book because they thought it was a bad book, but they would do it for me. They couldn't. They can't. Their entire reputation is at stake. Whereas Mr. Slammer, who came in here and gave me a 1-star, it was the only Amazon review he had ever given. He does not have an identity. There's no profile material. You can't look him up. You can't find him. And the only person's reputation he put at stake was mine. When people do that on Amazon, other people who are looking for books should know when you see negative feedback, you should check out who gave it. When you see positive feedback, you should check out who gave it. The guy that I interviewed earlier this week, Dr. Benebo, he's the second-ranked reviewer at Amazon. He said that there are people that literally, when they publish their books, they fake make up different personalities on there and give themselves high ranking all the way down. Well, if it's not a real person giving positive feedback, don't take that. If it's not a real person giving negative feedback, don't take that. But as an author, you have to know that people are able to do this anytime they want, and you need to protect your own work. Now, what I believe, we'll find out if this is true now because this is just my theory, but what I believe is that by having 9 positive comments, or I was even hoping for just 5 before I got slammed. I got 9 before I got slammed. I'm really happy with that. I'm hoping that the weight of these positive comments will so far outweigh this one that there will come more positives down here. Now, it may not go that way. It may tip the other way, and I have no control over that. The parts I have control over is writing a great book and then making sure that at least it has a chance of survival when you put it out to the public. We live in a culture of armchair quarterbacks who like to just throw darts at everything people do. The media, the politicians, I mean, we are rabid. We love ripping people to shreds as a society. It's just tragic. And I really, I mean, it's not all survivors' fault, but honestly, I really think a lot of it goes back to that, where the whole goal was to get rid of the competition, get rid of the competition. My own personal theory, and one that I've been living with for many years, and I love it because it works and it's kind, is to partner with as many people as possible. Here's what I think. If you are, let's say, a romance author, and I bring that up a lot because romance titles right now are the number one checkout genre from libraries in ebooks. That's hard to believe. That's a huge change. But romance readers will read a lot. They are always wanting to read the next book. If you are a romance writer and someone falls in love with your style, your voice, how you're presenting your material, they're going to read all your stuff, and they're going to look forward to your next one coming out. But what would happen is if in the back of the book you said, if you liked this book, here's more books by this author. If you like this style of writing, here's more authors for you to enjoy. What if instead of cremating our competition, we embraced our competition and said, you know what, I can't possibly write a book every day, and that's how fast you, reader, are reading my books, so let's give you something else to enjoy until I can get my next one out for you. It's really important for us to recognize that we are not all alone here in this world. We are partners with everybody around us. One of my business coaches, Linda Lopez, she says, envision your life as if it was a movie in a theater. She said, now scroll to the end, and what do you see? You see all the credits. One person didn't make that movie. All those people worked together to make the movie. Our lives are just like that. We need all the other people. You can't do it by yourself. So don't think you can, and don't cream the people who are your competition. Embrace competition. It makes us better. One of the things Amazon does really well is when it, on their pages, when they're looking, when the customer is looking at your book, it says, customers who bought this book also bought. They're using that whole concept of partnering to help the customer find the information they need. Okay, cool, it's working. They're using it for marketing, but it works in everybody's lives if we will share information. I mean, I could just keep this information to myself, and then nobody else would get to go publish their books on Amazon. And wouldn't that be tragic? My personal perspective is that each person has something inside of them, a unique perspective, unique information, a special way of doing something or saying it. That's what you bring to the table, your voice, your experience, your perspective, and other people need that. I hope that this allows many people to publish their books. Okay, outsourcing, how to find the right help. Outsourcing has been popularized by Tim Ferriss's book, 4-Hour Workweek. That was rejected by 26 publishers before it went to print by the first one, or by the 27th one, and it has now been in 40 different printings. It's in its 40th printing. A very popular book. He talks in there a lot about outsourcing, and he sure did give me motivation to do more of it than I've been doing. But even before that book came out, I had wanted to have my website for womenspeakers.com rebuilt. It's the number one site of its type. If you type in womenspeakers on google.com, it comes up at the top. So I wanted to make sure I stay current with the technology, and I needed a new database built for that website. So I asked my programmer, Ben Simon, of Ideas to Executable. He's over on the East Coast. I said, Ben, how much would it cost you to make this next level of a website? And he did all the work of this, and he came back and he said about $40,000. Well, we didn't have a cabin we could sell, and so I thought, you know what, I'm dead. I can't do it. How can I do this? And so I talked to him, and I said, isn't there any way we could bring it up to speed? You know, what could I do? And he said, well, why don't you outsource? And I said, what's outsource? And he said, well, like, people in other countries have lower cost of living than we do here. It's kind of the same as northern Minnesota has lower cost of living than Ben Simon on the East Coast. His house is priced three times as much as my house. You just have to earn what you have to earn to pay your bills. That's how it is. In other countries, the standard of living is much lower. They can charge less per hour and still pay their bills. And so what's happening is that this becomes available to us. And I said, well, okay, so like how would I go about finding somebody like that? And he said, well, I have a contact. And I said, okay. So he introduced me to James, and James introduced me to Manoja, and Manoja introduced me to Amrita, and we got that project done for one quarter of the cost in India. Now, there's some real advantages and disadvantages to working with outsourcers. The disadvantages are, number one, English is usually not their native tongue. That's a big deal. Number two, culture is really different. You can just really stumble over things culturally that you don't even know you're stumbling over. Number three, they sleep when you're awake, and you're trying to sleep when they're working. And that's really tough, but I like to sleep. So it's really hard for me to work with them because that means I have to give up some sleep. Usually when I'm working with my outsourcers, it's early in the morning as they're finishing their day and before mine starts. That's when I get to work with outsourcers. And during the major projects, I just give up a whole night's sleep because that's when they can work. Culturally, they're really not willing to give up their night's sleep. I need to give up mine. The plus side is that they do really good work, and they charge a fraction of the cost. During the editing process, I had editors that started at $5 an hour and went up to nearly $100. That's a big difference. They all did really well. None of them caught everything. So outsourcing is an option. If you can't afford to do it traditionally, paying a writing coach or paying an editor or paying for cover graphics or whatever, you should consider outsourcing. It tells you in the book, one of the fun parts of the book is blow by blow every conversation I had with my outsourcers during the production of the ebook. And then at that point, I quit including it. But you will learn so much. If you're even considering it, I encourage you to read through it. Each outsourcer has their own personality. They have their own. One outsourcer never did give me anything. Every time I talk to them, yep, they're working on it, never did give me one thing. Another outsourcer just became my hero, just awesome, awesome researcher. You're gonna see every kind of spectrum in there, but it gives you the rules to do when you're working with outsourcers. Outsourcers typically work in a company that is an overarching company, and so they keep track of their hours and all the payments go through that company. Those are called outsourcers. What we're used to in the United States are called freelancers. That's different. A freelancer is like the kid who comes over and mows your lawn, or your hairdresser, your lawyer, your accountant. People like that are freelancers. They are people who have a business, and they don't have an umbrella business all over them. They're just independent contractors, and you can tap into their resources as you need them and pay for what you get. That's a freelancer. Freelancers in the United States are wonderful. They're just more expensive. Okay? But like I said, I would prefer to work with U.S. freelancers every time because of the time and culture and language barriers with the outsourcers. I almost always have to work with outsourcers because of financial constraints of not having enough money to be able to buy time with the U.S. freelancers. What I do is I do a partnership. So for right now, like Ben Simon, my programmer on the East Coast, he's my middleman guy. If I cannot communicate to my programmers what I need because I don't have the technical know-how to cross that culture and language barrier, I pay Ben for a half an hour or however long it takes. He hears what I want. Then he communicates it to the programmers in programming ease that they can understand. They produce for me what I need over the period of the next few days. So there's ways to work with programmers, outsourcers. You can outsource everything. If you have a book idea and you just simply can't get to it, but it's something really important that other people should know about, you can outsource having the entire thing written. You don't even have to write a single word yourself, and you can have ownership of that book. People do it all the time. Used to be called ghostwriters. Now more it's done with outsourcers. Okay, we have covered a tremendous amount of ground. I'm going to go around one by one, and if you have questions, now's the time to ask. The one thing I did want to just conclude with here before we go to the questions and answers is in the book, there's information on how you can get your own ISBN number. People ask me about that all the time. The ISBN number is the code that's required for bookstores to actually handle your book. You do have to have one of those. So that information, it takes about 15 minutes. It's extremely easy online. Another thing that you'll want to know is copyright. Now, once again, I am not a lawyer, but here's how I understand it, and here's how I personally do it. Previous to all of this publishing option that I'm just explaining to you here today, the poor man's copyright, the way I understand it and the way I did it, was I would finish my manuscript to the best point I could. I would make a copy of that on hard copy paper. I would put it into a large envelope, address it to myself, sign it from myself, and put the name of the book on the outside of the envelope. Then I would walk personally into the post office, and I would say, please, as you mail this to me, please will you please put your stamp, your post office legal stamp, over the seal of the envelope. Why? Because the post office is a legal entity. It's owned by the government, and it is a legal entity. Once that seal is on there, it becomes a legal document. As long as you don't open that envelope, it's permissible in a court of law to prove that you own the copyright. Poor man's copyright. Worked for me, I never got contested on. I'm thinking, you know, if you're going to write about, you know, national secrets or something espionage like that, you might want to actually buy the copyright. But if you're thinking probably nobody's going to go out of their way to steal your material, the poor man's copyright could work. The other thing is, once you are published, the publication itself becomes the proof that you had it first. Okay? So if nobody else published it before you, the publication, the book itself, becomes the proof. So you don't necessarily have to buy a copyright unless you want to. If you go with a big publishing house, they're going to buy one for you. Okay? All right? And you can. Obviously, you can. And if it would make you feel better, you should. Okay. Very good. We covered a lot of ground. Let's start over here. Did you have any questions as we went along? Good? Okay. How about you? No? Okay. Very good. Very good. And you came in later. Did you think of anything along the way? Redo the first half. There we go. Okay, that's probably, if you get the book. It's all in there. How about for you? I know. It is. It's like drinking from a fire hydrant. That's what I felt like the whole time. You guys good? Okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. You're just going to write it. Actually, I really just encourage you to just go out and get a basic book from the shelf and lay your book out like that, one that you like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What you don't want to do with the e-publishing, you don't want to add the header and footer. You will. If you're going to do a PDF, you will, the traditional e-publishing. But for the handheld readers, if you add page numbers, guess what? They're not going to be the same. I mean, the page layout is completely different. So it automatically adds page numbers or that setup when you upload it to those systems. And that's another reason why you want a formatter to help you. As you're going along, that brings up a good point, though. There's two more things that you want to consider when formatting it. First of all, you know how sometimes you get to the end of a page and you just go return, 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 return until you get to the next page? If you do that and then you publish that into a handheld, you're going to make your people crazy. They'll be like, well, where is that next page? What you want to do is you want to go up to the top and use the legal correct function. It's insert, break page. So you're inserting a page break. And that's going to just take them right from where you leave off right to the top of the next page. Okay. The other thing is there's another manual or another technical one that you do like that too, and it slips my mind right now. Maybe you come back to me. Okay, how about you guys over here?
Well, I have to ask a copyright.
Yes.
Amazon and all these companies are making DVDs to copyright laws from every library or anything. I assume they're all like
Actually, the libraries buy e-resources in the same exact way as they buy a book. So, like this library, if it's a bestseller, you might buy how many? Three? Here? Six or seven here. Okay, so with this, you know, they might buy six or seven. It's the same with the e-product because they can only check out how many they have. And after that goes on your e-reader, when it expires, it goes off of your e-reader, and then somebody else can check it out. Well, it does. They have to pay for it, just like the regular book that they bought. It works in exactly the same way as the regular book, and there is a way for them to take it off of the checkout period ends at a certain point. So you can't, it's not like they own the book from that moment forward. I don't know. That's how it is with OverDrive. Is that how it is with your provider? And through that subscription, then the authors or the publishing houses are paid, and then the authors are eventually paid their portion of it. So So it's really very similar to a hard copy book. Yeah, that was a big question I had too. Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, between February 22 and 26 of this month, we're doing it for National Read Me Week. It's Library Month right now, and the 22 to the 26 is National Read Me Week. And I put together a group of eight guests who are experts that are willing to help you understand what you need to do to get published. So some of them, one is a book agent to help you understand how to do that. One is a publicist. You've got the author of How to Write Romance for Writer's Digest. There's a couple other people in there. Anyway, this whole training from the 22nd to the 26th, if you go to Marnie.com, the whole training is free to you, and it's complimentary to your local library. So anybody can go there, and you can let other people know that about that too. But what they are is they're just MP3s. There'll be MP3 recordings that you can just listen to and access. There's really, really good material on there. There's a training on how to do a cover. So doing a cover that can sell your cover is very important. You want to do your cover right so that it looks like it's done by a professional. When somebody's going down the rack, they shouldn't be able to tell, oh, this one's done by a big press and this one's done by George. You know what I mean? You definitely want it to just look like all the rest of it, read like all the rest of them, be as polished as you can that way. Okay, any other questions? You're good? Okay, any other questions people are thinking of and going on? Well, I know you could ask me questions all day, but go ahead and try.
Well, on this given a critique to the author, I have tried to give positive critiques. I got a note back from the company that I'd be careful not to do too much of that.
From Amazon, do you think it was at Amazon or somebody else? Amazon, similar. Well, you know, when I was talking to Dr. Benabel, he's given 16,000 reviews on Amazon, so I'm thinking they're not holding people down too tight. That's a lot of reviews. Could be that other sites are limiting how many you can do per day. Actually, you know, I hope that this situation can change, where just anybody can kill a book. I think it's wrong. I really think it's slander. That's what I think it is. That author, whoever it is, put so much love and care and effort and even money into getting that book published, to have someone just maliciously come along and slander it. I think it should be illegal, and I don't think that sites should allow it. But the way it is right now, I think like a site like Amazon, I can't even imagine how many hits it gets a day. It has to be, you know, million, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, if not a million hits a day, more than that probably. For them to try to monitor it, you know, would be very difficult. But I think that there must be a way for there to be some help for authors who get unfair treatment. And now I'm talking about unfair treatment because I think that anybody should have a right to give a poor review. If you get a bad book, I mean, it's really poorly written. You know, there's just the content is just, you know, all about, you know, nothing, and there's typos, and somebody just stuck it out there hoping to make some money real quick. Well, I think that probably it's okay for people to give that book a poor review so other people don't waste their money on it. But when you go around and you give somebody a one on a product that's really, I mean, obviously this book will always be able to get better than it is, but there's a lot of strong content in here. It's well written, it's well researched, and other people already said, this is a good book. When you come in and give it a one, you know, that to me is clearly malicious or slander. So I just think there's probably going to be some hope for something that will come and protect. But in the meantime, you have the opportunity to recruit some support before you go on there. Just make sure you do. Just do it. Don't leave it to chance. I mean, what did that take? 14 days or, you know, whatever, how many days that was before that happened. You know, it wasn't very long. You know, and I know it too. Like my site, womenspeakers.com, is one of the largest websites of its kind. It's definitely the largest of its exact kind. But it makes a really big target. You know, we've been hit several times. A lot of what I pay for is website cleanup when we get attacked. And that's unfortunate. But the bigger you are, the easier you are to hit. And so that's also true. And I think, you know, you when you go and you look at some of the best sellers, they've got people on there giving them really bad reviews. Okay, well, just know that's part of the game. You know, it's all part of it. So you just have to be tougher than, I always told my kids when they were in sports, you got to be better than bad refs. You just have to be better than that. Well, you've been a delightful audience. I'm so grateful that we could do this program today. Thank you, Alice, for recording it, and Barb for inviting me. And thank you all. I hope you have a great rest of the day and publish your book. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Yes. Okay, that's great. We have two points of business we have to take care of here. What we need you to do is at the back of your paperwork there, you have an evaluation. An evaluation that we'd like you to fill out. On the bottom of that, you're asked to enter your email address. That's where your PDF copy is going to go, is to your email address. If you don't have an email address, it's going to be hard for you to get at it, but maybe we can have a copy here at the library somehow or something like that. Also, Barb does have a question. She's curious how you all found out about this. So what are our choices? Maybe we can do a raise of hands here. What are our choices, Barb? One would have been in the library itself. How many of you found out about this event by publicity in the library itself? Okay, pretty much everybody. Okay, and then is one radio? What were some other? Radio? Nobody. No? Okay. You did? Okay. Okay. And then newspaper? Okay. Couple? Okay. Channel 3 on the, that's like a community news channel? Okay, all right. So, and that's TV, right? That channel 3? Sure. Okay, yeah. Is there any other? Oh, it's on the library's website? Okay, that was another one on the website? Okay, poster around town. Anybody see a poster around town? So overwhelmingly, people, you saw it when you were in the library here. Okay, good. Good, good, good. Ah, okay, well, thank you so much. I'm going to let you finish out your reviews. And for those of you listening online, thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us on the video, too. Okay, bye-bye.